experience in theology. And I'm going to try to give a little background on it, because it's one of those things that we all kind of know about, but when you start to think about what are the methods, what are the real approaches that we use to think about human experience in theology, sometimes that is a bit more fuzzy. So that's part of what we're going to do today. I realize each of these sessions that I'm going to do are going to, they're freestanding. You can drop in and not see any of the others. But I did want to tell you about them. So this is my shtick. So today we're going to do this feminist analyses of experience and sort of conversation with Rebecca Chopp and Serene Jones and some of my own work. Tomorrow we're going to look at, and in the process I'm going to use mostly illustrations from the experience of disability, because that is one of the experiences of my life, not the only one, but one of them. So that will link it in some ways to tomorrow, but tomorrow's is an entirely different kind of look at the Bible problem and disability. There are so many challenging texts when we begin to think about disability in ways that aren't traditional analyses of disability, like the notion that everyone who happens to be a person with disability longs deeply for the experience of transformation of their bodies, that that's the only way we really want God to touch us. When we start encountering those healing texts, we sometimes find ourselves up against some challenging obstacles. So we're going to work on the Bible problem, mostly in the New Testament, but a little bit in the Levitical codes as well. Then we're going to talk about the disabled God. It's another audacious proposal that is the notion that the resurrected Christ is for us a disabled God. I'm going to kind of tease that out. That for many people is unnerving, because those two things, God and disabled, usually don't get linked, because one is seen as all-powerful, all-knowing, the other's limited, unable. So we're going to try to think about what that might mean together. And the last session on Thursday, we're going to talk about disability and the politics of care. And this comes out of my most recent work. And this is really a question about dependence and independence. What does that mean in the relationships that we are engaged in, and how people actually experience these things? There's a lot of discussion about care in feminist theology. And so that's, again, part of my conversation partners are people who have themselves experienced disability, but often as parents of children with disability. And so we're going to kind of turn around. What does it look like? What does this politics of care look like from the perspective of perhaps a caregiver with a disability? And often in this context, I talk about the experience of the disabled pastor. For lots of people, that's a challenging notion, because, again, those things don't link together for some folks. So that's the long plan. But today you get a little piece of it. So we're going to talk about experience and the nature of the claims we make about experience for doing theology. And I've written on the board. Peter Berger is a sociologist of religion. I am a sociologist of religion and do theology, as I say often, by necessity, because the theologies I often found were just not adequate to the experiences that I was having, both of God and of my body and of the communal relationships in the world. But Peter Berger is one of my early mentors, and he has this notion of religion, which I think is actually a pretty decent one. You know, you can look in all kinds of textbooks about what is religion. You know, you can get all kinds of, it is belief and practice and all of these things linked together, and you fail to get one of them, you're missing the whole story of religion. But I think this is a pretty decent definition, and I give it to you because I'm gonna rip him off shamelessly in my definition of theology. Peter Berger says, religion is the audacious proposal that ordinary human life is somehow imbued with cosmic significance. It's as a person with a disability, places like this, remote places, have been off limits for me most of my life. So it's been a tremendous personal gift to be here. And it's somehow the cosmic force sort of seems, I don't know, it doesn't happen to me as much in Atlanta traffic as it does here. There's a sense that you were grabbed by there is cosmic significance not only to your life, but to the experience that we're having together, whether it's in worship, in conversation, in the nature of this kind of gathering. And I think that captures the nature of religion. Theology, I think, is the spectacularly audacious notion that the cosmic not only takes note of human affairs, but also actively intervenes in the everyday lives of ordinary people. Spectacularly intervenes, that's what that word is, it is barely legible, in the everyday lives of ordinary people. And of course, then that raises, I mean, we could go through this and kind of try to define each of the terms. I'm not sure that that's the most useful way to spend our time together, but it might be interesting. But the one I kind of come to is this everyday lives of ordinary people. Who lives everyday lives? Who are the ordinary people? Who is it that God is, the cosmic forces are intervening on behalf of? And that's really the place we start, because of course historically theology was fairly limited in the folks who were thought of living ordinary lives, or everyday lives of ordinary people, right? So we're going to start with thinking about the nature of ordinary lives and examining together a bit of that history, and then seeing some new conversation partners that I find particularly stimulating. I don't want to, in the end, I don't want to try to harmonize them overly. Serene Jones and Rebecca Chalk have different perspectives, and their experience allows us to, I think, sort of move in two different kinds of directions. So we're gonna talk about that a bit as we go on. But that's where we're going to start. You know, I don't know how they expect, hope we'll use our times. I'm trying to figure the pitch and how to use the time best, but it strikes me as experience is just not best talked about with anonymous other folks. Can we just at least go around and say our names? So when we talk to one another in a bit, we can, we won't remember one another's names, but we'll at least have heard them.
My name is Jeff.
Beth.
John.
Thank you. Well, we are going to explore some, you know, my husband always says, use more examples, Nancy. You always need to use more examples. So we're going to use my example some, but I'm going to stop and ask you for some examples periodically because, of course, I can't always come up with them, but then I first throw it out. So that's a good task. When I talk about theology, we all have different definitions, we all have different ways of thinking about it, but we all have different, I think in Christian theology we have certain touchstones that we have to attend to, right? We have to attend to the Bible, right? Even when it's a problem, as we're going to talk about tomorrow, we just have to attend to it. You can't just say we can do Christian theology without the Bible. We have to attend to tradition in some way. The tradition is always so multifaceted that we can't assume any kind of consensus in history, or even tradition in the McIntyrian sense that is nicely organized, right? You know, has a step through history and a kind of building of agreement. I'm not even persuaded that tradition works like that. We'll talk about it, but maybe. But we have to attend to it. We can't just say we are starting fresh, because of course we can't. Our hymns, our songs, our practices, all of it are linked to that history. We always have to attend to faith as well. This is one of those things that is not necessary in all world religions, but Christianity spends a good bit of its force and energy around the notion that you have to do something, you have to respond in some way. Faith is our expression of passion back to the cosmic force, right? It's a lot of different things, but we have to attend to it. And then we have to attend to this thing called experience, right? Experience is what we bring to the work of theology. This is where I belie the fact that I am really a sociologist at what I do theology, because I always say, whether in classes about theology or classes about sociology, that we do in order to believe. Right? We don't have beliefs in our head. We don't accept doctrines. Like, you ever notice, if you haven't been going to church for a long while, the whole pattern of Christianity begins to seem not particularly persuasive. You know, you're not the baptism. What the heck is all that dipping of water? And, you know, or different practices that you find not as persuasive when you're not doing them routinely, right? So we have to do in order to believe, right? The belief comes in part not just from our individual practice, but from being persuaded by all the other people who are persuaded by the same thing, right? And so the task of theology is inevitably to characterize the nature of this thing that we're doing in common and the thing that we are bringing to it, the experiences outside, that we may or may not have in common. And so we're constantly trying to use the experiences of God both in a religious setting and in our non-religious context to think about the nature of God and the nature of this cosmic intervention, the nature of our faith, the way in which tradition shapes us today. Our experience, I would argue, again, we're going to talk about this, we can argue that, our experience really is the first step. Can't get outside of it, can't assume that it doesn't matter, can't just mentally do gymnastics to put yourself in another experience you've never had, but we can practice what I'm going to call empathic hope. And that is the work of working together to put other people in the speaking center so that we can hear their experiences and learn to relate them to our own. And we can't just make this mental leap, but we can do practices that challenge ourselves in the process. So this session, we're going to examine how experience enters the theological conversation. And I'm going to make some proposals about both the conscious and unconscious ways we make arguments about normal, ordinary, right? You go back to this everyday lives of ordinary. Who's the ordinary ones, right? We have immediately in our head, I would bet, even though I probably, you know, I wouldn't be 100% right on this, but I would bet immediately we think of some ordinaries. Things that typify our lives, the lives of folks around us, and that there are some things that just don't occur to us as ordinary. We don't think of them as being part of ordinary lives. In fact, disability is one of those things that we think of as extraordinary. Of course, that's partially because the biblical tradition teaches us to think about it as extraordinary. But of course, if we look at all of the people that were not being healed, Hector Avalos talks about in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible, the temples were often used as places of health care provision. And so they were more than likely populated with people who had incurable disease, more disability than average. So that the questions about disability, both in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament, though it's not called that, are really questions that are vital because they oversample, as we could say in sociology, for folks with disability. So the issue is, he argues, that as many as 40% of gathered people in the temple at various rituals would be in some way touched by what we would now call disability or serious chronic illness. That we oversampled. And then moving into New Testament research, Rod Stark, who has argued that the reason Christianity was so successful was that it provided a place for all of those people with health problems in particular who were cast out of their communities. So again, Christianity in its early days oversampled for people with serious chronic illness and disability. So the stories that we bring forward from the Christian tradition teach us in many ways that the Christian story has been a story about disability. Often hidden from us, but absolutely a story about disability. Let me put them on the board, because first one is Hector Avalos. He's done a book on, do you get the, anybody who wants this got this? He did a book, two books actually, on healthcare in ancient Near East, and Rod Stark, who is a kind of wild child sociologist who's done a number of books on sociological reasons for the success of communal groups. He's not really looking at the theological content. He's just asking, well, why did Christianity succeed? And he looks at it trying to see the through tombstone analysis and other things. Hector is very much involved in tombstone analysis. All right. Hector's, one of his pieces is, they told me I'm supposed to plug these things. It's kind of embarrassing. Is in a piece in this book that Don Saliers and I edited, Human Disability in the Service of God. So you can find Hector's piece in that. Rod's is, the book is entitled The Rise of Christianity. All right? And anytime, please stop me if you don't understand what it, or if you want references, or if I'm going to do something that I told somebody at lunch is like a deal breaker in a voluntary voluntary gathering like this. It's to refer to Schleiermacher. It's like all bets are off. You can sort of watch them walk out of the room. But of course, if we're talking about experience, we kind of have to talk about Schleiermacher. So I'm going to make it brief. And I'm going to try to, I'll tell you what I think, you know, Schleiermacher is one of those people you read and read and read and you're still not sure you really understand. At least that's my experience with Schleiermacher as a non-academic theologian, at least. But Schleiermacher argued that doctrine, practice, metaphysical belief, and ecclesiastical institutions are all secondary accretions to the primary nature of experience, which is the sense of absolute dependence. That's the phrase, if you want to remember anything at all about Schleiermacher from this. The notion that experience is absolute dependence, right? It's an interesting image, right? It's an interesting image. We, of course, Tillich redoes these things for us later on, but absolute dependence, what might that mean? What do you think of that meaning in relationship to your own experience of faith? Do you have any way of talking back to Schleiermacher on that? What might absolute dependence mean? You know? This is where I have the illustration. It's a challenge. Well, part of what it might be is the experience of cosmic. The cosmic experience of being claimed, right? You ever think of situations? I'm going to use my experience of disability. I'm a person with a lifelong disability. I'm going to tell a little bit of my story a little later. But I was about 25. I was in a brace in a pulley thing that you put over the end of it. What do you call this thing?
Traction.
That's it. Thank you. That traction in my home, because it was on the 13th floor of an apartment complex. And it was me and my husband. We were all that were living with one another. And he had to go to work. And he said, okay, we got everything set up. You know, there's just no way you could be without need, with need in this context. You know, everything set up. TV guide, the whole nine yards, right? So it was in an international, it was in a university apartment, and a couple floors below us, an international student was cooking dinner and got cooking in a wok, and the fire got hotter than him. And so there was a fire alarm. And when the fire alarm would happen in this building, they'd turn off all the electrical system. So I had no phone line. And I went, I can't let anybody know that I'm here. I don't know if this is a real fire. I have no idea. And at that moment, I had this experience of absolute dependence on the fact that my husband was not there to be helpful to me, right? I don't know if you've had experiences like that in your life, but that makes me think a little about what Schleiermacher might mean. Experience that you're claimed in ways that not always is pleasant to you. You're claimed by the experience, for me, of disability, the experience of dependent, but also in ways that are linking, relational. So, Schleiermacher, 300 years ago, this German theologian, has been extremely influential through the history of theology. He established that religious and human experience are fundamentally interactive in private ways. Right? They're about our private connections with others, and they're preconceptual, he argues. Or before we have words and thoughts and symbols for them. It's just that feeling in your gut. And I can tell you that was the experience of hearing the clanging, the feeling in your gut, okay? And maybe you've had that either at baptism or some experience of Eucharist when you kind of knew that you were not your own. You didn't have the capacity to even care for yourself in all of these, but you didn't really have ways to speak about it. That's a little bit of a stretch on Schleiermacher, but I think it's within the frame of Schleiermacher. We're going to kind of, what has this effect been, right? Well, I'm going to talk about denominational theology rather than individual theologian. Most denominational theology has reflected this notion that experience is private and often preconceptual. It's only been in the last, I would say, 20 years when we began to think about experience as congregational again. And it used to be just kind of the faith of the individual people that we were trying to touch in the experience of worship. But now we often talk much more about formation and kind of faith. But in part, that's the effect of folks like Rebecca Chapp and Serene Jones and other feminists, as well as sociologists of religion and others. So theologies work, according to Schleiermacher, in order to focus our attention on personal experience, personally being grasped by God. And that notion that personal experience is the most important thing, the most important element of experience incorporating theology, has shaped us in many different ways. The work of theology today, I think, is a redemptive reimagining of selves and communities and creation that helps us put that personal back in more conversations and to make that preconceptual idea of experience clarified through the practice of what we are doing. We don't have, experience doesn't come out in doctrine. Right? This is some of my colleagues who are systematic theologian. You know, they go through the loci. I think the loci, you know, different salvation, redemption, all of these. They go through, and I have to admit, maybe it's because of my background in Pentecostalism and Lutheranism, sort of in mix. I have always a challenge kind of starting with the loci because I start so much from the notion that we practice something together, We practice the laying on of hands, and that helps us think about a theology of redemption. We practice the gathering together for the Eucharist, and that helps us think about the creation of God. You might have a very different way of thinking about it. Obviously, systematic theologians do so. So at least some of them do. I'm not characterizing them as great. So that redemptive reimagining of selves, communities, and creations has to occur at multiple sites and in lots of different bodies, each with the expression of the love of the Creator. Lots of different sites and lots of different bodies. But we're not just doing experience individually or corporately in ways that do not intersect. The reason we are together understanding experience as something that is inevitably important to theology is that we're thinking about it and we're doing these things in relationship to the absolute persuasion that the love of the Creator has shaped all ordinary experiences. I'm pointing to something that's no longer on the board. All ordinary experiences. And that's where we're sort of working at, trying to figure out what does ordinary experience mean then? If we are not simply saying, your experience is not my experience, and therefore I can't understand it. Right? Sometimes we get what philosophers call incommensurability, the inability to say, you have an experience of a young man, and I've never had that experience, so of course I couldn't understand what you're going through. There's sometimes a kind of movement in that direction. But of course, we are united by the love of the Creator. And so that is not an acceptable out for us. We can't do that. We can't just say, interesting experience, I don't have that. Right? We are united by the love of the Creator, and so we have to work through empathic hope to try to understand, what does it mean to be a young white man in contemporary society? What does it mean to be other experiences, to have other experiences, to be shaped by multiple experiences that you may not have? All right, let me stop there. Any questions or comments or puzzlements about what the heck I've been saying? Ask me to repeat something in different words?
Yeah, I asked this book and I was thinking about a couple of things. I'm going to ask about how would you touch I work with a deaf kid in Billings, Montana. And in their sign language, they developed a kind of theology, and I'm still not sure that I agree with it, but it's fascinating and it's meaningful. Mm-hmm. So faith, you know, how would you sign faith help you? How would you develop a sign to portray what it is? In our community, and I don't know if I'm elsewhere, is a thought to hold on to. This is like rope that is given you. Faith is a thought you hold on to. It's not an experience. Whereas you contrast that with trust. Trust is just holding on and being no thinking about trust. No, it's that cut. And they also do belief a little bit differently, but it's really the same definition as faith. It's also a thought you hold on to. This way, like you hold on
hands
with another
with
person. Yeah, so belief is holding on to God, and he has a sense of the rope coming faith. Now, since you're talking about disability, it is interesting to see how others
That's true, and there's so many different forms of disability that when I talk about disability, I really have to talk about it partially out of sort of my primary focus in physical disability, but I'm always fascinated in
rich. And I have a voice disability. That's the reason I started learning sign language. Because they don't think my voice is
No. Oralism. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
when you were talking about empathic hope and that utter dependence, I think one of the most profound experiences I've had of that is my former parish. I led spirituality discussions in the local hospital's alcoholism treatment center. And I'm not alcoholic, and there are some who would challenge that a person who's not alcoholic couldn't work for recovery. But it, because the experience of out of controlness is so concrete for alcoholics when in treatment, I really felt like I always made great discoveries of my own utter dependence through their experience. Learned a great deal from that.
I think there's a step when you go beyond. First of all, I'd be interested in what draws people to be interested in hearing other experience. And then there's something I think that's required of us then that goes beyond just hearing it.
Absolutely.
And then what are we called to do with those other experiences rather than just hear them and validate them? Like, how do they become part of our systems and our institutions and stuff like that? So it's one thing to hear, which is a step, but it's another thing then to take the next step and do something with that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you.
You had quickly mentioned that you had walked in the area of the charismatic movement.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Which is a highly experiential theology.
Mm-hmm.
And how has that affected your research? And it's interesting that's all woven into our
Let me tell you, just as I said at the beginning, I said I'm a theologian by necessity. I'm trained I did a Master's of Divinity, and I'm a lay Lutheran. But that's not always the typical profile to do theology. But my training is actually mostly in sociology and religion. But as I said, my experience through my life of having people with different theologies, from charismatic, high church, Episcopal, range of folks trying to figure out what to make of my disability has involved through my life a great deal of pain and unstableness. I've been in wheelchairs for a good period of time. And what do you do with someone in that circumstance? What theological sense do you make of it? And the challenge has been that people work very hard. I have a great deal of appreciation for the charismatic movement. It's not theologically where I'm at, but it is a set of practices, particularly I talk about in my book, The Disabled God, the practice of laying on of hands. It can be a way of claiming a person for a community that is often simply not done for people with disabilities. The statistics on people with disabilities is that we are more likely to be single, we're more likely to not be partnered in any way, we're more likely to be physically abused, we're more likely to be in the context of deep poverty, and we're less likely to be welcomed in work, school, religious education, and religious context generally. So the experience of isolation is profound for many, many people with disabilities. I was just rereading a piece by women's work in disability. And the women were talking repeatedly through the experience that work was often one of the most isolating places of their lives. People didn't want to talk about their experience. They often used chairs or had speech impairments or other forms of hearing impairment, but people didn't want to even acknowledge that it happened. You know, sort of, let's pretend that your ordinary experience is as though you were an able-bodied, not misbegotten male. So, you know, the whole experience of charismatic theology, I would say, has helped me think in different ways. I've had a lot of, as my generation is wont to have, I've had a lot of different religious traditions. But the charismatic experience, I think, helped me think about experience and make sure that we at least define it and acknowledge it, right? Because historically, when we talked about experience, we just used it as an implicit category. Augustine used himself, of course, as the model of all Christianity, right? And that's not bad. I mean, Augustine's a very interesting person. I think I would have lots to have conversation with Augustine, but his experience did not model everyone. And we've seen this through history, in which the experience of a person is used to talk about the nature of all people's experience in the Christian community. And that, I think, the experience of working with charismatics and in charismatic context made me think, you know, you have to define this, both in the more human, secular context and what you mean when you talk about religious experience, right? That is a complicated set of issues as well. So I'm not sure that answers it enough, but it maybe gives you a little picture into my experience. Theologies are exactly like other belief systems in this respect. They depend on indirect experience to confirm the reality of their constructs. Right? We don't believe. We do, and we try to believe in relationship. That's part of what Rebecca Chopp's work really brings to the fore. Rebecca Chopp is a Wesleyan theologian. She's now president of Colgate University, but she was a colleague of mine for many years at Candler School of Theology. And she is a feminist liberation theologian. Her work initially started looking at Latin American liberation theology, and then trying to see if there's a North American interpretation and way to employ elements of Latin American liberation theology without being untrue both to the specificity of where it comes from and the nature of the project that does have a preferential option for the poor in the context of Latin America in particular. She began by troubling a good bit of water, by troubling the water of folks who thought about the common human experience. That was a typical way that experience was brought into the method of thinking theologically, the common human experience, right? David Tracy, if you back up, it was Tillich that was there. If you back up Tillich, it's actually Calvin, I would have. You know, so it's there, that common human experience. Well, what the heck is that, right? She began by noting that Latin American liberation theologian says, doesn't include many of the people with whom we minister, right? So that the focus on common human experience is not common, does not include some of the breadth of the human experience. And it tends to, she argued, rationalize and homogenize experience, right? We get sexless people that are really male, or we get genderless people that are really male, or we get able-bodied people that actually may in fact have experiences of disability, but not sort of name them and bring them to the fore, or not including racial and ethnic diversity, not assuming certain class statuses, etc. So that rationalization and homogenization is dangerous, she argued, in doing theology. We can't afford the notion of common human experience. Well, what do you do once you've said this is a problem? Well, how do you engage it? She argues that you start by talking explicitly and acting explicitly into relationship to six things. You don't have to remember them all. They overlap and interrelate. So one is difference. Difference matters. The specific rather than the general. The specific rather than the general. Embodiment in all its messiness. Solidarity in all its partialness. Anticipation in all its bemusement. it's my turn for it, but just amusement is, she says a lot about this and power to speak. And again, sometimes I reread that and I'm not sure I understand all of it, but it's bemusement. There's a lot of anticipation of the eschaton in a way that we sort of experience is not quite sure what it's going to be, bemusement. And transformation as a liberatory practice. Each of these are extremely fecund. We can work on them. She doesn't define them all in ways that sort of, as a sociologist of religion, I want to be able to operationalize, as we call it. I want to know the limits of that concept in relationship to this one. She doesn't do that. I think poetically doesn't do that, because it's a beautiful work, power to speak. But it does allow us to think about how we break down that concept of common human experience. If we've got some of these other concepts kind of working in the mix, I think of it as, my father, I grew up on a farm in rural North Dakota, and we used to have to crush our own gravel to gravel our road, because we were, I guess it's remote, and not the way that you're remote here, but remote, and different. We had to put gravel down because you get these awful ruts. And so my father, we'd have this rock crusher, right? And you'd just be tossing things in. My father would be tossing, I'd be watching toss them into this rock crusher. And you sort of see as they kind of push against each other and break apart. And I think about this, the concepts in that way. They kind of push against each other and begin to break apart this notion of common human experience. And breaking apart is a necessary part of, I think, the reconstruction of empathic hope, because we can't start with, well, your experience is just like mine, right? Often I hear from folks, and I may offend some of you when I say this, so you're welcome to speak back to me later. We're all disabled in various ways. Right? When I talk about disability, we're all disabled in various ways. Metaphorically, that may be right. Right? We all have various limits, metaphorically. But the fact that I am labeled disabled, I have a governmental label that says, yes, she is one of those, means that my experience really is fundamentally different than those who either don't claim the label, even though they may have the experience, or are limited in certain ways, but aren't disabled as a form of in the disability system, meaning a formal way we scale bodies. We say, these are the good ones, these are not so good. And we've got an institutional setting for that, right? We're not just sort of imagining that this happened. These are institutionalized in ADA, in the Americans with Disabilities Act, in the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, in the way in which we ask for accommodations in educational institutions, the ways in which people get labeled as they go into elementary school, et cetera, et cetera. It matters that some people carry the label disabled. So even though we may have limits that make us see commonalities, we also have to look at the fact that the label brings some other things. All right, the other thing that Rebecca Chopp contributes to an important conversation is the rejection or the pushing back of the notion that we are all at home in the Christian tradition. I thought it was a lovely litany last night, the welcome, we will welcome. And I kept thinking about that, even as I have a bit of insomnia. So I was thinking about this welcome. And it was a puzzlement to me, thinking about, are we welcome? Can we be welcome? How do we welcome each of these different groups? It is absolutely true that most of those groups that were named in our litany have not found an at-home situation in the Christian tradition. The Christian tradition has made us alien to itself. We haven't said, oh, we don't want a part of this. We have wanted a part. Right? As I said earlier, the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament talk about the people who we now call disabled, who are wanting part of this story, wanting the good news for themselves, and it's been the case through history. And yet, the stories that are given to us are often not particularly life-giving. So, as a child, I was taken often to healing sessions. I would have loved to experience that transformation that we see in the parables in the biblical story. It's not that that wasn't something I wanted to claim in the Christian tradition. It was simply not the way the Christian tradition could claim me. So after a while, that story was no longer a liberatory or a good news for me. When I hear, and their eyes were opened, and the lame walked, and people jumped, and dancing happened everywhere, not exactly good news right off the start of it. I had to work a while to figure out. So the Christian tradition has not been something that wanted us, wanted our experience. Either the poor, as is particular in Latin American liberation theology, or the various forms of marginalization that we experience in the North American context, whether it's sexual orientation or the experience of disability, or women. Bobby Patterson, in a piece in this that I was looking at again, talks about the experience of, she's an Episcopal priest, the experience of being shuttled aside constantly as she was seeking ordination early on. She was one of the early folks in the Episcopal tradition trying to be ordained. Her experience was just not quite right. It wasn't quite what they were looking for. And of course, I experience with lots of students who come who are people with disabilities who want to work in the congregation, who want to fulfill their call. But lots of places find it troubling to think about pastor with a disability. Lots of denominations find that hard to overcome. And there are certain acceptable disabilities that can, you can kind of make the mark. But then the scaling of bodies drops to the place where, this one is not an acceptable one. So the at-homeness in the Christian tradition that is often assumed as part of the experience component, Rebecca says, we must trouble. And we must think of the ways in which the church has refused to address and affirm the dignity and self-understanding of populations that we now want to begin to hear from and act in relationship to. Chopp argues that theology must work its way forward through the interplay between what is already known to the theologian or person of faith and the active engagement with a particular people when each person and each group is asked to rework their theologies, their labels, and their beliefs and depictions of ordinary life. Now, once we invite someone in to what I call the speaking center, we can't just listen. As I sometimes, as you exactly said, I'm in context, little context, maybe that's the where we have what I call serial inclusion. We have one week in which we're including this group, and so we all pay attention. And then it's the next groups that turn to be inclusion. I don't think that's, I think it comes from goodwill. I don't think it comes from ill will, but it's not liberatory transformation. We have to note the difference, right? We can do that on the way to liberatory transformation. We have, one of the things that Rebecca has taught me is there are all sorts of pragmatic partials that we work toward, that are as good as we can do. As good as we can do now. And that's sometimes as good as we can do now, but we ought to know the difference between that and liberatory transformation, in which each of our theologies is transformed by the conversation and the experience of another group that has been historically marginalized. And I know that happens with me. Now that I'm working through another thing in the work, I realize there's elements of disability I've not fully attended to, their experience of sexual life that I've not fully attended to, their experiences of race and ethnicity that I've not fully attended to. That doesn't mean I can do it all. But I have to note that this experience is part of a conversation in which I'm trying to ask, how does it relate to people who are in those other experiences, that interplay, right? The rock, the gravel chopper, that's what's written, the gravel thing.
Pressure.
Thank you. Thank you, Stacy.
I was surprised a few years ago, maybe some of you read it as well, Oliver Sacks, the neurologist from New York, had an article in the New Yorker about people that he had worked with and come to know who had either been blind or had been deaf from birth, mm-hmm. or it developed over time over their life, and then those who regained or came to sight later in life or hearing. And in this article, he shared the story of people who actually, when they gained sight, wished that they could return to the place before, because that was much more joyous than what sight was. And it gave a whole new perspective for me on disability of really, these people were saying, this was gift in my life, and this is actually now my disability. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, there's actually, the name just, you know, it's a moment when you can't, there's a British theologian, anybody know his name? He's a person who's blind. Mm-hmm. And he had sight earlier in his life, he had gradual blindness. And he argues that, in fact, blindness for him was a gift of God, and that, in fact, his theological orientation has been true.
Isn't it like John Hull?
John Hull, yes, thank you, John Hull. His theological orientation has been transformed by blindness, and that he would not return. He would not ever return. And, of course, that's often the question, those of us with disabilities, you know, would you not? And I always say, you know, I have no idea what I would be. And it's a bit, again, the story of people sometimes, when they have particularly literal views of heaven, they'll ask, well, in heaven, you won't have disability, right? Like, you know, I have no idea who I would be without my disability. My disability has shaped my entire life, and if that has to be excised for me to enter into the heavenly precincts, I'm not sure where I really want to go. I don't know where I'd be, and I'd be kind of lost there. And of course, Gregory of Nyssa says that he would know his sister, Macrina, by virtue of her scars in heaven, right? This isn't just something I'm putting. Gregory of Nyssa thought that, in fact, his sister would be, or as he calls it, adorned with the scars of her life in heaven. And that's how he would recognize Macrina. So, comment?
The determination of who gets to say that is going to take the doom out becomes an issue, too.
Sure.
It sometimes would be a lot better for the other group to be able to say that's as good as they can do now. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Because who's determining that's as good as they can do usually is not the other group.
Yeah. It's true, and I write in another piece about the lament that the necessity of ongoing lament for the fact that it's not as good as we could do, right? Even as we acknowledge that there is power in who says this is good as it gets right now, we also are celebrating the possibility of emancipatory transformation and empathic hope, and as always life is, lamenting the fact that we're not able to do this always. Right? We can't practice empathic hope. My daughter had a breakdown at lunch, and I found myself thinking, this is, you know, empathic hope, you know, I'm like, sit, quiet, eat, you know? And anybody who's had experience, an actual human experience, knows that we have real limits of empathy, real limits of the capacity to be hopeful with the other, right? So we have to work within the fact that I'm willing to use these concepts to undermine the basic notion of humanity, that God has made us human, not God, right? And that is fundamentally to mean that we are limited, and that is a gift of God. Not a curse. The limits are a gift of God, not a curse.
Could you spell Richard Chuck's or Rebecca Chuck's name?
Sure.
Sure.
me move on here and I'll give Serene short shrift. Well, I probably will give Serene short shrift anyway. Alright. So let me just say one word to conclude this on Rebecca. Rebecca says, as I've spoken about along the way, that this interplay is always in the service of a greater goal, the emancipatory transformation of the social system. And that is not something we know ahead of time. Right? We're not she's pushing back against certain Marxian views of we can envision the utopia that we're all trying to work to. We don't know what that's exactly going to be. But the interplay and the practice of working with one another will show us, God will be revealed in God's cosmic intervention. Okay? All right. I'm going to take questions and comments in just a minute and go on to Serene. Serene Jones is a Reformed theologian, feminist theologian at Yale, and she has done lots of different work. But one of the pieces that I want to talk about today is the nature of God and God's work that is fundamentally relational. It's one of the things that I really appreciated about her contribution to the feminist conversation. She really pushes us to recognize that we are related, even as we think our experience is so different than that person's. We recognize that slowly, if we can kind of trace our connections, we are related in various ways, and therefore are dependent on one another. Dependence is the basic interrelationship. And she says, or she argues, that this is, of course, the Trinitarian model. Right? The Trinitarian model isn't a kind of division of labor, right? That's actually how I think. I think I either heard it as egg or division of labor. But anyway, it's, you know, the Trinitarian theology is, you know, one does this, another does this, another does that. She argues they're all dependent on the possibility. Whatever we think of the Trinity might be, it is dependent on the common possibility of it. That may be a word stronger than she would use sometimes as a Reformed theologian, but I think I'm sort of in the ballpark there. The kind of claiming of the persons of the Trinitarian, of the way in which they have to be related in order to be God, right? In order to be who they are. So too, we have to recognize our relational links in order to be who we are. Until we've done that, we of course are not who we are. We are not becoming who we are. At birth and at baptism, we enter a circle of women and men whose aggregate humanity, tenacity, complexity, and plain interestingness constructs a cultural narrative that is an account of the world negotiated from the vantage point of mutual responsibility. That's actually more the term, responsibility. I will admit this is not her, this is my, this is not a quote from her. At birth and at baptism, we enter a circle of women and men whose aggregate humanity, tenacity, complexity, and plain interestingness constructs a cultural narrative that is an account of the world negotiated from the vantage point of mutual responsibility. Right? We have mutual dependence and mutual responsibility. I always do in my sociology of religion class, I ask students to start unpacking the people with whom they've interacted on a religious plane within the last week, who they, and mostly they start with traditional religious context, right? And then they start thinking about the laundromat, and soon they realize that the webs of connection that is religion and is this cosmic claim upon us link us in ways that we wouldn't initially imagine. That's I think what Serene is pointing to, at least in part of her work, that's what Serene is. And I think that's a particularly good conversation partner with Rebecca's work on emancipatory transformation, where we focus some on difference, specificity, all of those things as well, so that we're thinking about, on the one hand, there is this experience, on the other hand, we are related and responsible. So how do I link these? How do I link these? Constantly, that is our question. Jones emphasizes the possibility for a holistic view of redemptive embodiment that is counter to much of contemporary emphasis on individual embodiment. Her approach asks, how is embodied life distinct as a shared experience, a communality, as well as an individual experience? Much of feminist theory early on sort of started frankly, I think, from what I put gynocentric feminism, really that focused on the experience of pregnancy and birth, that started at looking at that very communal but very individual experience. And so much of early feminist theory in that genre, not liberal feminism but gynocentric feminism, really focused on experiences and individual account. And it was much very linked to our bodies, ourselves, right? That whole movement in Boston, the midwifery movement. And that's an important contribution of the feminist conversation, an extremely important contribution. But there's also this reweaving of experience as a communal thing that we share, that we are always negotiating with one another, and that is never simply our own grasping by faith, our own experience of God. This is perhaps my response to part of the experience of charismatic. There's the personal relationship with personal relationship with Jesus, usually, right, is that it's always at least a little troubling to me. How is that different than their communal relationship with? Why? Yeah, I'm not sure that it's bad, it's just a little troubling. And I think in part it is the appropriation of American individualism into the theological norm of personal relationship with. But Serene invites us to this larger conversation and I think allows us to think about a web of our common redemptive growth. A web of our common redemptive growth. So we get this notion of emancipatory transformation from Rebecca that moves us toward a social transformation, social and symbolic transformation. And from Serene, I think we get this notion of a web of redemptive growth that is a bit different. And they're not exactly, their orientations, the orientation from Latin American liberation theology for Rebecca is different than that of Serene's. But I think they both allow us to think about what experience can be when we do it as a common project rather than simply either individual or from our appropriation of that common human experience that homogenizes and generalizes and doesn't take the specificity and difference that is so vital. Well, why is this important for me? Well, I'm going to say one word and then we're going to close so you can talk a little bit. The ways in which we work together to reinterpret experience are the ways in which we can work together to reimagine practice and rework practice as an ongoing project of redemption in the world. Right? So that experience matters as a basic theological category because it's what we can imagine. It's what we can work with. It's part of this what I talked about is of putting people in the speaking center, but that's not all. It's about how we can imagine ordinary lives. Can we imagine a person with profound developmental disabilities living an ordinary life? Is it an extraordinary life? What kind of life is it if it's not an ordinary life?
How is our life, how would our life be transformed should we experience some disability? How would we understand the story of our lives as still part of an ordinary life blessed by God with limits that are changing, that sometimes allow us to think of ourselves as temporarily able-bodied, and sometimes challenge us with the label of disability. So that experience and ordinary life are so fundamentally linked that I think we have to work on that concept in order to really begin to think about disability as part of the world in which we practice our faith together. All right? So I've got a couple of questions that would prompt conversation, but you may have questions that would prompt your own puzzlement in conversation as well.
What I'm hearing from you is not a redefinition of truth, you know, having gone to seminary, the Augustinian truth is truth, but acknowledging that we as ourselves, as people who experience our reality, in our relationship with God, we can also truly call that truth. And that can actually be truth. Our personal experience with God, we can say, is truth.
Say something more so I understand it a bit more.
I've walked the different areas you have also. Feminist theology, mm-hmm. for me, Catholic theology, charismatic theology, mm-hmm. Lutheran theology as a seminary. And my experience in seminary was constantly saying, for me, your experience of God is not what we're going to call truth here. Mm. This is the truth here. And what I hear from you is very liberating for me, the way I'm receiving it, as being, there's validity in these many areas that we dance in, because God is present in all of those.
And it's always a part, our experience is always in conversation with tradition, doctrine, Bible as well. So it's not as though our experience can just kind of take us, but our experience is always in that circle of God's created, the love of our Creator, right? That's why we are responsible to one another. So I think you're absolutely right that the ways in which our theological orientations have often focused us is to say, well, you know, we are kind of misbegotten. If we're women, misbegotten men, or if you're disabled, you're sort of not yet in the full grace of God. Or, if, you know, there's all kinds of ways. If you're gay or lesbian, you can be included but not fully included. And so there's all these ways in which our experience have been, we've been told that our experience is not the right one to do theology from. Various of us have told me. We start with a different experience, the right experience to start with theology. And what I'm saying is that the feminist tradition gives us lots of resources to work with the fact that we have so many different experiences, that specificity and difference is, in fact, how God is going to be revealed in our lives and in the world, right? We have not yet seen what God can and will be, because we've not yet seen the full range of human life. And so that is the unfolding of God. Are people with questions or comments or puzzlements or disagreements?
I wonder, as a sociologist, when you look at how people respond to different theologies, I find this interesting. If you take the experience of marginalized people and think about how that needs to redefine our theology, and then you have the sorts of theologies that try to be more open, when those get preached, I go to places where that gets preached, and everybody looks about the same, you know? And then you hear this kind of really conservative, traditional theology gets preached in South America, and lots of poor people come. You go to those churches, and there are lots of people with disability in those churches. Or I think about, like I'm at Duke University right now. Duke tries to be, you know, open, and we want to welcome, you know, minorities, and you've got about like 5%. But Pat Roberts, you know, at Regent University up there, has like 22% minorities coming. And you just think, well, what in the world? I mean, you know, what is it that's drawing these people that are excluded in other ways to very kind of traditional conservative visions of theology and eschatology and all that kind of stuff?
That's a big one. That's what I think about my sociology. I'll take a stab. I mean, the first is simply demographics, right? I mean, the evangelical context doesn't have as many converts as we often think, right? Mm. The statistics are simply that they reproduce more, right? So there are simply the demographics of evangelicals having more children, and that doesn't answer your question exactly, but it does respond at least to some of the perception in context where the notion is that they're, you know, they're sort of pulling them from all over. Mm-hmm. And I think that in some contexts that's true, but it's not so true in the U.S. That evangelical growth is not, has been plateaued for a while, and it mostly the growth has happened through higher birth rates. So, but the other piece of it is that, in fact, when you have very little theology of hope anywhere, mm-hmm. we of course find, I mean, if you really are an excluded person, say with a disability or in poverty, if the story is that we will help you make money, we will help you find a place, we'll help you find a healing, when no one else is even acknowledging you exist, why would that not be a place of hope? So I think that there's a tension between the fact that we don't address it because they're not there, and the fact that they're not there because we don't address it. And we have to close, and Antonio will have burned this, as I think I'm supposed to say. Right? So, but we can have some conversation outside. Please do. Thank you.